Okay, I'm going to call the Division of Long-Term Care to order. Please take your seats, members. I am looking for a motion to approve the February 4th minutes.
So moved.
Okay, Representative Olson moves the minutes for February 4th. Any discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Same sign. Okay, minutes of February 4th passed. And now I need a motion for the minutes from February 25th. Who would like to make the motion?
Moved.
Representative Olson moves February 25th minutes. Any discussion? Corrections? No? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition?
Thank you.
It's passed. Okay, we have a quorum. And our first testifier, I believe, is here, Representative Lean. You want to come to the table and bring your testifier? Okay, I'm going to move the bill, House File 258. I'm going to re-refer that to Health and Human Services Finance. Refer the bill to HHS Finance. Thank you. So, Representative Lean, want to present your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I appreciate you hearing this bill today, House File 258. And this bill would provide a rate for nonprofit nursing homes located in Moorhead and also Breckenridge equal to the median rate for nursing homes located in North Dakota cities contiguous to Moorhead and Breckenridge. This bill will finish work that was started in 2015 when a similar provision for a nursing home in Breckenridge was enacted. Although seeing a more realistic state budget now, North Dakota in recent years has raised its Medicaid rates paid to nursing homes. This led to a wide disparity in rates paid in border communities and resulted in severe staffing issues for nursing homes located on the Minnesota side adjacent to North Dakota cities. In 2015, the nursing home reform bill did help address the disparity as the downturn in oil production in North Dakota did occur. However, this bill is important to ensure that the crisis situation does not happen again. This bill is important to maintain the needed services and access to MA beds for the elderly in the Moorhead area now and in the future. Members, I urge your support for House File 258. And with me today is Nathan Johnson from Eventide Lutheran Home in Moorhead to testify on the bill.
Welcome, Mr. Johnson. Just introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nathan Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of Eventide Senior Living Communities in Moorhead, and I'm here to talk about our nonprofit nursing home in Moorhead. And I want to thank Representative Aline for bringing this legislation forward. During the recent economic boom in North Dakota nursing facilities were increased substantially. During that time, the average rates paid to these North Dakota facilities was over 20% higher than our Minnesota rate in Moorhead. The difference caused a severe staff shortage for Eventide and jeopardized our ability to maintain our MA beds in Moorhead. This crisis was resolved for the time being due to the slowing of the North Dakota economy. House File 258 would help us avoid another potential crisis in the future in a community that encompasses two state reimbursement models. The 2015 nursing home reform legislation has without question helped us with this issue, and for that we are grateful. However, the rate system includes a lag period that with another North Dakota economic boom would create substantial challenges until the rate system lag catches up. I encourage you to support House File 258 as a solution to the North Dakota border city problem and make providing medical assistant beds in Minnesota viable into the future. We have the need, but currently much of our Minnesota need is being met by North Dakota facilities. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Do we have any questions for Representative Lean or Mr. Johnson? Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Lean. This nursing home situation has got a lot of ups and downs in it, put it mildly, okay? The question I have is that the Breckenridge St. Francis home previously had a rate add-on but will no longer receive the increase. So does that help you as far as it'll actually be lower than rates paid to the nursing home in Minnesota? does that help you as far as addressing the request of this bill?
Mr. Johnson or Representative Lean?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Grunhagen, a little bit of history on this issue. The Morehead facility and Breckenridge were tied together under one bill a couple years ago when Breckenridge got the additional rate increase beyond the overall reform that happened in 2015. We've been trying for a couple of years to get Morehead also basically back to have the same legislation as the Breckenridge facility. What this bill does, and we had an amendment to the bill that was in the HHS Policy Committee, basically to say, okay, for both of these facilities, we're going to bring them under one law, or one proposed law, the change under this bill, and it would put the onus for the administration on the rate increase onto the facility. So right now, basically, DHS, just for the Breckenridge facility, has to take a look at the differences between the North Dakota side and Breckenridge, and if those differences are higher on the North Dakota side, they're going to pay the Breckenridge facility that additional amount. Basically, what this bill does, it says for the facilities, they have to do some of that administrative work. So taking a look at the rate differences, taking a look at the cost differences, if the rates are going to be lower in North Dakota, then the two facilities would both have to basically ask DHS for the rate increase. So basically we're trying to bring both communities' facilities under the same law under this bill, and then to put the administrative work onto the facility rather than DHS to have to do the rate comparison and increase.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for that response, Representative Lee. So have you talked with the Breckenridge home, and are they okay with losing this add-on?
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Grunhagen, we have not yet. I know the folks at Eventide have been in communication with Breckenridge, having those conversations, but I personally have not heard from the Breckenridge facility. But again, basically it's putting both communities' facilities on the same footing in terms of this law.
Okay.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Breckenridge and actually Wahpeton, North Dakota is kind of home of my family, so we grew up in that area, or my dad did, and this is an interesting bill. I know that many family members that I have that live in Breckenridge actually moved to North Dakota because of their tax structure, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but the income tax in North Dakota for people that work at the facility was only 1.1% income tax versus 5.35 is the lowest tier we have in Minnesota. It's almost five times more income tax in Minnesota. So as you're addressing the disparity between North Dakota and Minnesota for regulations on businesses, it's important to address that we have a completely different tax structure in Minnesota, and it kind of goes hand in hand. We're taking more money from Minnesotans, and we're competing against all these other
Munson,
states.
I hate to interrupt you, but I think we need to deal with that in the tax committee and not this committee. So if you have a question about the finance or the fiscal note or language in the bill, I think we need to narrow our focus there.
Madam Chair, I'm frustrated that we're trying to subsidize businesses on the borders of our state competing against neighboring states when we're not really addressing the underlying cause.
Representative Lean, would you like to respond?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Munson, I would pretty much echo the Chair's comments that this is about rate reimbursements, not state income taxes. That's a separate issue, a separate committee. And the reason for the rate reimbursements is because, again, North Dakota, they had a large oil boom at the early part of this decade, and they decided they were going to take a lot of that money and put it into their health and human services programs, into their reimbursement rates. So that's really the crux of this issue here. Now, the oil economy in North Dakota has slowed some, and this bill would serve more or less as a backstop so that if they were to have that large boom again in the oil money and they decided to use that money for HHS reimbursement rates, that on the Minnesota side, we'd be able to act accordingly to help out these border cities that have very unique, very specific circumstances.
Okay, any other questions? No? Okay. Do you want, Doug, you want to just, Mr. Berg, you want to review the fiscal note quickly for members?
Madam Chair, members, in your packet there should be a fiscal note for House File 258-1E. It's pretty simple. On the first page, you'll see that it has a cost, an estimated cost in fiscal year 2021 of $81,000 and ongoing costs in 22 and 23 of $136,000 and $31,000 respectively. If you read the narrative, it will mention that this is, of course, speculative based on guesses about what North Dakota rates will be, and those could ultimately be different. It is, as Representative Lean mentioned, up to the nursing homes to apply to DHS for the change they're looking for.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Okay. Any other comments, questions? Are there any other testifiers that would like to testify in support or opposition to the bill in the audience? No? Do you have any other testifiers, Representative Lean?
Madam Chair, committee members, I appreciate the time and you hearing the bill today, and I ask for your support.
Okay, with that, we'll vote. All in favor of referring this to HHS Finance, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Okay. Passes. Thank you, Representative Lee and
you.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Okay, the next item on the agenda is House File 1565. So on deck, we have Cheryl Hennen from the State Ombudsman for Long-Term Care Office. Representative Lippert, would you like to move your bill to Health and Human Services Finance?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 1565 to be referred to the Division on Health and Human Services Finance.
Excellent. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, in a presentation earlier this session, we heard from the Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care about their work as a primary advocate for consumers receiving long-term care services and their work with long-term care facilities as well. And we also heard about their staffing levels, that their staffing levels are last among states and also below the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico as well. As we are listening to concerns about elder abuse and determining ways to respond to these concerns, one response is making sure that the staffing level for this office is has the capacity to meet the needs of these concerns and complaints and is in line with other states. So this bill will be calling for 25 additional regional ombudsmen and 6 support staff for work such as supervision and data management that will put Minnesota in line or in bring our staffing levels up to the average of the states that border Minnesota. And with that, I'll turn it over to Cheryl Hennen.
Okay, welcome, Ms. Hennen. Just introduce yourself to the record, please, and then proceed.
Thank you, Ms. Chairperson, and thank you, Representative Lippert. I am Cheryl Hennen, the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and I appreciate the time before you today. Just to give you an overview of the role of the Ombudsman's Office, we are a program of the Minnesota Board on Aging. We are established in Title VII, Chapter 2 of the Older Americans Act, as well as Minnesota Statute 256.9742. I'm proud to say that we are a program of the Minnesota Board on Aging. Our Executive Director, Carrie Benson, is also with us today. We have a unique role to provide direct consumer independent advocacy with a focus on prevention. We not only do complaint investigations, but we also conduct trainings, provide consultations, including consultations to providers. House File 1565, as was nicely explained to you earlier by Representative Lippert, includes 2 separate appropriations. One is for 25 additional regional staff located throughout the state of Minnesota, and these costs include travel, lease expenditures, and supplies. This is $2.1 million in fiscal year 2020 and $3.5 million in fiscal year 2021. The second appropriation is for central office staff. This includes people who would provide supervision, provide policy support. We are an office that receives complaints directly, so we have people answering phones on a regular basis, first point of contact. So for the six additional staff, that would be $818,000 in fiscal year 2020 and $977,000 in fiscal year 2021. And this cost includes our volunteers, because we do project that with additional regional staff, we would also expand our volunteers. And keep in mind, the importance of this expansion is for a presence in long-term care facilities. And while most often you hear nursing homes and assisted living in facility types, our scope expands beyond that. We do investigate complaints against county social service agencies, against medical foster homes for veterans, veterans homes, hospitals. So we expand beyond nursing home and assisted living in our complaint work. So this funding will support an increase in 31 additional staff and allow us to provide advocacy to more people and work to protect those receiving long-term care services. I also want to point out to you that the biennial total fiscal year 2021 would be $5.1 million, fiscal year 2022-23, $6.1. The total expenditures are reduced by $950,000 in fiscal year 2020 and $1.4 million in fiscal year 2021 as a result of expected federal financial participation. So a map. This map shows you how we what our current configuration is. We have five regional ombudsmen in the metro and nine in greater Minnesota. So the numbers do not tell you how many people are in there in those regions. It just identifies the region. And this is where we show you that the we are at approximately one full-time person to 9,000 beds when the national average is 1 in 2,000. And we also want to point out that some staff in greater Minnesota, so if you look at pink, which is number 2, that's one example of where the staff are spending an average of over 80 hours per month just traveling alone. One region is around 19,000 square miles. So, and currently we have four community offices. The remaining people are working out of their homes. I've established a community office in Grand Rapids, Brainerd, Mankato, and then the central office in St. Paul, with a very keen eye on making sure that we are efficient in those costs. So I was asked to, what will you do with these extra people? So the map that you have, you should each have an independent Minnesota map in your materials. And this map would show you where I would put the 25 additional staff. So it would be 25 plus the current 14 equals 39. So this would bring us, as was testified to earlier, an average of one FTE to 3,300 beds. And so how did we make these determinations? So what you're looking at is there would be 21 regional ombudsmen in greater Minnesota, which is what you're looking at. What we didn't pull out are the separate seven county. I didn't provide a map of the seven county, but you see the arrows going out from the metro. And you have, for example, one in Wright County. That means we'd have one regional ombudsman in Wright, two in Anoka. So we'd have 21 regional ombudsmen in greater Minnesota and 18 in the metro counties. And we would also look to expand the number of community offices in the Rochester area, southwest Minnesota, the Twin Cities, and the northeast section. And so the other factors that we use to determine this proposed regional configuration include the license type, the bed counts in each area, troublesome areas. What does that mean? That means that's where we spend a lot of our time. I look towards our staff to be explaining where they have a lot of work going on, as well as windshield time. And we also do a lot of work with other stakeholders in terms of serving on committees. So there are a number of factors that we took very good care to show you, well, where will you put these people? I want to introduce you to some of the clients that we have to give you a visual of the reason why we are all here today. Meet Bernie, and I do have permission to be sharing his picture, sharing his name. So when we met him, he provided us with the note that's to the side of his picture. And what happened here is he received, the first bill that he received from the provider caused him very extreme alarm and anger. And what had happened is the charges that he thought he was being charged were exorbitantly high upon his first bill. So, and he also felt he was being treated disrespectfully. And after the regional ombudsman got on board, we were able to review the contracts and confirm that certain fees and charges were not disclosed at the time of admission. And as a result of this, and working in collaboration with the provider, we were able to refund at least half of the charges, and the bonus, the provider agreed to change their contract language to prevent this from happening again. So not only did we influence to a positive way Bernie's life, but also the rest of the folks living there. Edith. So Edith is a model from New York. She was discovered one day having lunch in one of the finer cafes. Who knows, you could go eat somewhere and somebody wants to hire you as a model. And like most of us, she followed her family to Minnesota after her, after she retired. And we became involved with Edith because she was being told that her use of her power chair was to be restricted within her living environment, as well as she felt retaliated against and was facing involuntary discharge. So in this particular case, we did represent her in an administrative law judge hearing. And we were able to do away with the involuntary discharge, and she no longer felt that she was being disrespected nor retaliated against. You're getting a high level of what the concerns were, but I want you to see the faces of people that we serve. The next picture, if you look at this wonderful people that live in a nursing home in northern Minnesota, the woman standing in the background is one of our volunteers. In this particular setting, the resident council had, they would discuss that they had systemic issues, problems happening with their provider, and they just didn't know how to resolve this. How do we go about this? So with the help of the volunteer, they developed a concern form. And with the help of the volunteer and the regional ombudsman providing oversight, they met with the administrator. 2 weeks later, every one of their concerns were resolved. Is it always that easy? No. But what I want to show you is how we utilize our volunteers under the direction of regional ombudsmen in being a presence. It's also important to me as your state ombudsman to hear back from people about how well we are doing. So every case that we investigate, a case has to have at least one complainant, which could be the resident or a family member. We open a case on our system. We work to resolve it. When it's closed, we send everyone a customer satisfaction survey. And so I provide for you some of the responses that we received on the customer satisfaction survey. Do I have 100% responses that say how wonderful we are? No. But I want you to see that we are making more of a positive difference than not. And I especially appreciate the ombudsman came to my rescue when facility was threatening to kick my husband out because they couldn't care for him. She talked to me and then to them, and the threat disappeared. So oftentimes we are able to remedy the situation.
I also going to stop right there. Yes. I think Representative Gruenhagen, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, the and it had to do with the staffing. I think the national average is one ombudsman to every 2,500 beds. What would, if we add all of these, what would the ratio be in Minnesota? Do you know right offhand?
If we were able to reach the national average, we scaled that. Thank you, Representative. That's a very good question. It would add about 65 people. We would need about 65. And so to be more reasonable, if you will, we looked at, we need to get at least as good as our neighbors. So I serve as part of Region 5 with all the state ombudsmen that are in the states around us. So we get their data. So it would be 65 plus if we were to get close to the national average.
Representative Gruenhagen?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So we'll be at about half of that.
Mm-hmm. But at least as good as those wonderful states that border us.
So did you say we would be at 1 to 3,300
right.
ratio with
right.
these with this number
right.
of additional staff members, 1 to 3,300?
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions at this point? No, please proceed, Ms. Hennen.
So individual complaint handling, approximately 80% of the case complaints we receive are substantiated. So the federal government lays out over 130 categories of complaints that we are to, and whatever is coming to our attention, we must investigate. And then we also must record a disposition, which means whether or not we verified it. So, and then are they substantiated, or are they just something that someone just made up? But 80% of the complaints we receive are substantiated. The complaints that we are investigating are significant issues. So as I have been having many discussions with a number of people, the question common has been, are just most of these complaints about lost socks or lost clothing or something of that nature? Those are important to people, by the way, when those things happen. But most of the work that we've been dealing with are significant issues. And what we have learned to do with our small, stretched, thin number of staff is if we cannot get out there, we provide consultation to empower people to hopefully get this done and then follow up with them. The beyond casework. In 2017-2018, my staff conducted approximately 4,500 activities, which gets at the consultations I talked about earlier. 70 trainings to facility staff, 200 occasions of working with resident and family councils. We also must participate in the Department of Health facility surveys. So what does that mean? When a nursing home is surveyed, they must contact the ombudsman's office to see what kind of complaint work we have had. So we work to be participating in those as much as possible. I think another important element to know about is that the ombudsman program is part of the state's elder rights system envisioned in Title VII of the Older Americans Act, which means that the ombudsman program and the State Union on Aging, which is the Minnesota Board on Aging, we work together to develop the elder rights agenda each year with our stakeholders, with our partners. And I wanted to make sure that people also understand the reach that we have coordinating cross-training sessions with other agencies. Systemic issues, direct work with providers. So as your state ombudsman, I find that I feel that it's very important that if we have a number of the facilities owned by one particular organization experiencing the same problems across all their facilities, that I invite those owners to meet with me. And the health department has joined me where we meet face-to-face across the table and talk about the problems and give a chance for the provider to understand what we're seeing and how we can work together on a plan to eliminate and prevent these issues. So I've been fortunate that at least two major corporations in Minnesota they've agreed to meet with me to go through those issues and come up with a plan to eliminate and prevent those problems. And then lastly, again, I'm just going to focus on our volunteer program, which talks about, you see there, we currently have 35 and 2,572 hours have been generously donated. But I assure you that when we have extra staff, and I'm going to be optimistic that this session we will obtain more staff, we will recruit for more volunteers around the state. And I just really want to thank you again for your service and for allowing me time today on your agenda.
Thank you, Ms. Hennen. Representative Lippert, do you have another testifier? Is Chris? Oh, Representative Gruenhagen, do you have another question?
Oh, I just a comment, Madam Chair. You know, Representative Lippert, your last bill at a different committee I was a little contentious on, but I actually like this one. Okay?
Thank you,
Representative. Thanks for bringing it forward.
Any other questions for Ms. Hennen? Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's just a general knowledge question. As a new person to the legislature, I'm curious about long-term care facilities as a whole. Just at a 30,000-foot level, I don't want you to get into the weeds in this, but how many of our nursing homes are owned by corporations? Yeah. How many are owned by family members? How many are community-owned? Do you have just a general distribution kind of thought?
So I know that there are very beautiful minds in this room that probably have a better answer than I would. And I can tell you that with the work that we have, most of them are owned by major corporations and organizations. There are a few, and I apologize to those who may have the numbers, that are owned by private parties, by individuals. And remember, too, we have authority in the veterans homes, and we have 5 state-run veterans homes. But I would say that we have a significant majority that are part of major organizations.
Representative Cleburne, we will get you that information.
Yeah, it's just, as she was speaking, it was just something that I was curious about. Thank you.
When we hear another nursing home bill, we'll make sure that we bring that information forward for the public as well.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Hennen? No. Is Christine Sundberg here to testify? Hi, Ms. Sundberg. Please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Chris Sundberg, and I'm president of Elder Voice Family Advocates. And we're primarily family members whose mother, father, or other loved one was seriously harmed in a senior living residence in the state. Elder Voice, AARP, and Legal Aid are here to support the additional funding for the Omnibus Office. They are unique in being able to help our members, and many of our members have taken advantage of their services, and many others who also have taken advantage of their support and their guidance. This is really the only way that we can really, or one of the ways that we can assure our residents get quality, safe care. As I think most of you are probably aware, there were 4,000 complaints in 2010 to the Department of Health. That increased to 22,500 last year. So it's no surprise that we've seen the Ombudsman Office experience a dramatic increase. They've stated that there was 150% increase in abuse, neglect, and financial exploitations received from 2015 to 2018. It is very clear in the data that Cheryl just presented and in the graphic that we've included in your packets that they are grossly understaffed. As you can see, Cheryl had cited about 9,000 beds per ombudsman. Our graph only goes to 2016, so it's a little bit less, but it's been averaging between that 6,000 and 7,000 beds over the last few years. And that puts the ranking at 50 out of 52 states. This is nothing to be proud of. Now, even with this funding, it will start to close the gap, but that'll only close to getting us at 38 out of 52. Again, I think we can do better than that. unrelated to the provisions of this bill, but I just want to make a point of it, is that we need to give the ombudsman clear enforcement tools, as well as the need to make sure that termination and appeal rights are strengthened and that there are effective protections against retaliation. As you heard Cheryl talk, there's a great deal of fear about retaliation in these facilities. Providing additional staff for the Ombudsman Office provides the oversight that we need to keep our elderly and vulnerable adults safer and with better care. We very much appreciate your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sundberg. Are there questions? Representative Munson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is about the volunteers that your program uses. Do you know if other states leverage volunteers in their programs? And it's got a few questions, actually. Do your numbers here, what the staffing ratios reflect the volunteers, and can you just speak to the job duties of volunteers?
I think that question's better directed to Cheryl. We're just a volunteer organization of families that have been impacted and been benefited by Cheryl.
Thank you, Ms. Sundberg. Ms. Hennen, could you introduce yourself again for the record and then proceed to answer the question, please?
Thank you, Chairman. I'm Cheryl Hennen, State Long-Term Care Ombudsman. So question, would you, Representative, mind just repeating those for me, please?
Representative Munson?
Sure, Madam Chair, members, questions on the volunteer program. Mm-hmm. The numbers in your data that show the staffing ratios,
right.
I'm assuming that the volunteers are not included in those ratios, but do you know of other states that have volunteers? And can you speak to some of the duties that the volunteers do for the program?
Ms. Hennen.
Thank you, Chairman, Chairperson, and Representative Munson. So, yes, other states do utilize volunteers. And they utilize them in the same way that Minnesota does, which is you have paid staff regional ombudsmen that provide the oversight. There are some states that have volunteers working. They may contract out. The state may contract out the ombudsman program, and so the person, the grantee, has volunteers working for them. So there are some states that have just a little bit of different structure than Minnesota does, but primarily the structure is around in many states the same way we have in Minnesota. And the responsibilities of the volunteers, to your other part of the question, includes first and foremost being a presence. And they are trained. The regional ombudsman provide them with training that is specific to what their scope of authority is. The Older Americans Act is quite clear about who can actually conduct investigations versus who can come and assist. So some of our volunteers are trained to provide assistance in the complaint investigations. Volunteers have been part of the Minnesota Ombudsman Program since the 80s, and in its inception, they provided a presence, which is telling people who we are and what we do. But as time has moved along, I have found that we needed to train them a little bit more to assist with the investigations, and they also do provide support to councils. So volunteers are doing those things.
Representative Munson?
And I have one more follow-up question. Are volunteers for this program allowed to be employees of long-term care facilities, or is that a conflict of interest, or do you have any volunteers that are employees of facilities?
Ms. Hennen?
Thank you, Chairwoman. And Representative Munson, that is such a very, very good question, because within federal regulations there is clear definition of conflict of interest. So if a person is to volunteer with our program and they are working at a nursing home, they would need to quit.
Okay,
so thank you. Very good question.
Thank you.
Representative Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And mine was more of just a comment that I think Ms. Sundberg mentioned in her testimony, but also that this is a really great proposal and can go a long way to getting where we need to, and I'm glad to see this coming forward. And it seems that if we're going to do this, this is the time to be talking about the tools that are necessary to make sure that families are safe and able to, when your folks are doing their good work and they hit the roadblocks, that we need to make sure that, you know, the time to invest in the work you're doing also comes at a time when we need to be thinking about the tools around retaliation and expanded rights and all of that as well. So,
Representative Olson, thank you so much for making that statement. And I also want the committee to know that we are working on performance measures so that at any time when we have more staff, I would be ready to explain how well we are doing and what those performance measures look like and how well we are meeting them. That's very important to me that we have those checks and balances in place as well.
Thank you. Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So which state is number one on this? You know right up, Ann?
Ms. Hennen?
As far as the ratio?
Ms. Hennen?
I do not.
Okay.
But I would certainly be able to get the committee that information.
Okay. Any other questions? I think we have another testifier.
Yes.
From Care Providers of Minnesota. And then on deck we have Leading Age Minnesota, too. You want to come down? Sure, Carrie.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, yeah, just one follow-up comment. You don't have to go back to testifying today. When you look at that, has the additional staff reduced the number of complaints? You know what I mean?
I think, Representative Gruenhagen, that's the number of complaints that has increased over time. So
I know,
their workload,
the state with the smallest ratio, has their number of complaints gone down? You know what I mean?
We'll look into that, Representative Gruenhagen,
and
get
you
that
to
information.
Check on that when you, okay.
Thank you.
Please
introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Erin Bowie. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Care Providers of Minnesota, here today as part of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I want to thank Representative Lippert for bringing this bill forward and also the Ombudsman in her office for the work she and her staff do. 60,000 Minnesotans will turn 65 this year and next year and every year in the 2020s. Soon, we will have more seniors and school-aged children for the first time in Minnesota history. As our population ages, the care needs for Minnesota seniors will increase, and they will be turning in increasing numbers to our senior care communities. As you heard, Minnesota's funding for staffing the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman lags behind the rest of the country. The Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman plays a valuable role in working with consumers and providers to reach productive resolutions to concerns and complaints. The role for this office is only going to increase in the coming years, and we support efforts to increase the staffing numbers in the office. It is important for consumers to have an independent advocate in our settings, and it is also frequently of assistance to providers when the Long-Term Care Ombudsman becomes involved in helping mediate disputes or resolve complaints. Again, I want to thank Representative Lippert for bringing this bill forward, and now I'll turn it over to my Long-Term Care Imperative colleague to say further nice things about the bill.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Senior Vice President of Advocacy for Leading Age Minnesota, also here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. So I want to echo everything that has been said about the importance of this bill. It is an important tool in the prevention of elder abuse and the protection of seniors, and the Ombudsman's Office provides important advocacy services on behalf of seniors throughout the state of Minnesota. I also want to acknowledge that the Office of Ombudsman are incredible partners to the long-term care provider community. As Ms. Hennen indicated, they are great partners in providing training to our facilities throughout the state, and we find that an important tool in the prevention of issues before they become really significant. As many of you know, the discussion about how we regulate long-term care settings and how we best protect elders and vulnerable adults throughout the state of Minnesota has been an important topic since last session. And I want to acknowledge that in the course of late last fall, as well as in the winter, the Minnesota Department of Health convened a series of stakeholder working groups on a number of topics so we could identify a variety of solutions to bring forward to this legislature. Ms. Hennin led one of those working groups on consumer rights. And one of the areas of strong consensus, I think it's fair to say, in the working groups, is the call for additional funding for the Office of Ombudsman. I think that no matter whether there were providers or consumers at the table, this was one area that we all agreed upon as having an important tool. So I want to share that. We know that there will be other legislation also that this committee will look at in terms of looking at strengthening rights and addressing other tools. I know that that bill will make its way here and want to acknowledge the work of Representative Schultz as well as Representative Olson on that. And we look forward to those continued conversations as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bowie and Thurlow. So are there any questions for these additional testifiers? No? I think, Representative Lippert, do you have an oral amendment you'd like to move?
Yes.
And we can have our House research explain that for you.
Yeah, so I move to amend this bill to include the costs listed in the fiscal note.
So, Ms. Punelli, do you want to explain the oral amendment to the members, please?
Madam Chair and members, in consulting with Mr. Berg on this, he gave me some numbers to include where these blanks are, but these numbers aren't going to include the federal financial participation, so they would have to be adjusted later.
Okay.
So.
Yes, Mr. Berg, can you explain that, please?
Madam Chair, if you want to know, we actually account for FFP separately on the spreadsheet in all areas at DHS by law. So on a fiscal note, it's offset against the costs. The numbers that Ms. Pinelli will put in are the gross costs. When we get this to actually an omnibus bill, we will separately account for the federal offset.
After 8 years, I understand that now.
So, Ms. Pinelli, do you want to explain what these numbers are for an oral amendment in this committee? Or the Representative Lippert, you could choose to do an amendment when we have different numbers in HHS Finance. What do you recommend, Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair, it's fine to put those numbers in. It's just when it shows up on the spreadsheet, there will be an offset to these numbers. The problem here is that actually all of these aren't two different area budget activities. It all is going to get appropriated to the same budget activity, so it isn't possible to sort of allocate it separately now, the offset. Mm-hmm. It'll all be handled together ultimately. So you can put the numbers Ms. Pinelli has in there. It's fine.
Okay. Go ahead, Ms. Pinelli.
Madam Chair, members, so on page 1, line 7, the motion would be to delete the first blank and insert $2,151,000, and on the same line, delete the second blank and insert $3,577,000. And then on page 1, line 11, delete the first blank and insert $818,000 and delete the second blank and insert $978,000.
Okay, so do the members understand the oral amendment? Mm-hmm. Okay, any questions? So Representative Lippert has moved this oral amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Lippert. Any closing remarks before we take a vote?
I think this is a clear need, and this bill provides a good step forward for us.
Okay, so the motion before us is to move House File 1560. Oh, sorry, Mr. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. you know, the bill only funds staff for 2 years. Do we want to extend this funding so that we don't drop back to 50th in 2 years?
Mr. Burke?
Madam Chair, again, the convention we have on scoring the budget rules are that if there is an appropriation in the second year of a biennium, and also these are forecasted programs, it's considered an ongoing appropriation. If it doesn't say it's one time, it's automatically scored as ongoing.
Okay. Good question, Representative Grunhagen. Thank you for the clarification, Mr. Berg. Okay, so Representative Lippert renews his motion to refer House File 1565 to Health and Human Services Finance as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Motion's approved. Thank you, Representative Lippert. Okay, next on deck, we have a presentation on Own Your Future Minnesota. Is Ms. Snatterud here? She is. Please come to the table. Members, we're going to hear a presentation on long-term care insurance. This is an initiative that was started, I believe, under Governor Dayton in 2012. Currently in Minnesota, Medicaid funding for long-term care is projected to increase 9% per year in the 2020s. And it's projected that the number of those 65 and over receiving long-term care funded by Medicaid will double between 2010 and 2050. So Own Your Future is a way to address our future needs for long-term care expense spending so we don't crowd out investments in education and other important investments by the state. So please introduce yourself for the record and please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Larae Knatterud, and I work in the Continuing Care for Older Adults Division at the Department of Human Services. I'm the lead staff person on the department's Own Your Future initiative. I'm going to be joined this afternoon with Lynn Blewett from the university and Fred Anderson from the Department of Commerce. We'll all be talking about different parts of the Own Your Future initiative. Because we feel that the kind of work and the results that we're developing provide important information to legislators that have to deal with aging and long-term care. You should have two handouts. One of them is a four-pager that kind of describes all of Own Your Future and its accomplishments. And then you'll be getting a PowerPoint that Lynn will use to describe the information on the model. Excuse me. First of all, let's say a little bit about the other people who have worked with us. We have a team of people that represent a number of other state agencies, including the U of M, MDH, Commerce, Revenue, other units in the Department of Human Service, and also the Minnesota Board on Aging. So we're grateful for their involvement and using their expertise to help us in the work that we've done. Own Your Future is a joint federal and state initiative that was created in 2001 by the feds and several states to begin to encourage individuals to create a plan for their long-term care, including how to pay for it. Clearly, the state and federal governments were beginning to assess the impact on their budgets of the dramatic growth in the aging population. We've already heard lots of examples for how old we are getting, where we've always aged as individuals and now we're beginning to age as a society. I know I've used this before, but a few years ago I went to my uncle's 94th birthday party and I asked him, how do you feel, being 94? And he said, oh, Larae, being 94 is the new 93. So we're all aging and 70% of us are going to need long-term care. So Minnesota became interested in the Own Your Future initiative in 2012, and the focus up to that time had been to look at public awareness, the 27 states already involved. But as is often the case, Minnesota wanted to expand that effort, and so we included public awareness, but we also began to look at product development. We felt and we believed that if we wanted people to take action for their long-term care planning, we needed to have affordable products and things that they could do to provide some additional resources for helping pay for long-term care. So developing more products that were affordable was another thing that we added to Own Your Future. A third piece was to look at and evaluate the ability to move Medicaid program in various ways that it could incent people to pay for private financing of long-term care. So those were the things that Minnesota added to the Own Your Future. Just very quickly, what are some of the things that we have been working on related to each of those three? The first one is public awareness. With federal financial help, we were able to send letters signed by the governor and the lieutenant governor to 1 million households in Minnesota between ages 40 to 65. Within 2 weeks, we had 40,000 hits on our website. Quickly, the volume became less than that, reached a more moderate level, but we continue to have a website and have that available. We've also published a consumer's guide. I believe there are copies around available to you. And so far, that consumer guide for how to plan for long-term care, we've distributed about 50,000 of those, and we continue to do that, especially at the state fair. We've also been out at the state fair doing a survey each year to monitor what people answer to one question that we ask every year, and that is, if you had physical and mental disabilities and needed care, how would you pay for that? And what we have seen is that there's been a decrease in the number of people who say, I don't have a clue how I would pay for that, which is comforting to us because it looks like people are starting to take this more seriously. Many people are helping and caregiving for their parents, and so they're beginning to see that they really do need to have a plan rather than just assuming that things will work out. In terms of product development, as I said before, we realized that in order to help people of middle income be involved in their own long-term care, we needed to find products that were affordable and useful and suitable for people in the middle income households. What we decided to do there is to have part of our advisory committee take a look at the kinds of private proposals that could be developed that could be available to middle-income households in Minnesota so they could use that money to pay for long-term care rather than looking at Medicaid and other public programs. As a result of the work of that subgroup, we were able to identify two products that we've been working on in the last couple of years that we feel have great potential for helping people of modest means pay for their long-term care. The first one is what we call a life stage protection product, which basically merges term life insurance with a long-term care insurance policy into one combo product that then provides the breadwinner protection early in someone's career and then converts to long-term care after retirement. Fred will talk a little bit more about that in a couple of minutes, but we found that there's tremendous savings if this were to be made available because it's affordable and it actually provides people with maybe $100,000 or more that would be available for long-term care. A second product that we think has great potential is an enhanced Medicare home care benefit that would provide non-medical services through the supplemental plans that people buy, most people buy through the health plans we have in Minnesota. Having non-medical services means that you can really provide services that help people stay in their own home, in their own community, rather than having to leave that and move into a more congregate setting. It also blends well with the medical services that are already covered by Medicare. We have found that the premium is also very affordable and consumer interest is high in this, and there would be significant savings if that were available to people in Minnesota. Another tool that you'll hear about in a minute is the projection model that the University of Minnesota developed and has been using to assess financing options, the two that we looked at, and it would be available to do more of that. So in summary, why is the work so important? What kinds of things are we able to gain from this? It's a way of bringing more private money into long-term care financing, which will help our economic growth. It increases the use of that private financing money so that we can reduce the public expenditures in Medicaid. And in order to do that, we need to have products that are attractive, understandable, and affordable to consumers. And that's what we've been working on in our product development. And if we can reduce the fiscal pressure through Medicaid, we can have more funds to do things for healthcare, infrastructure, education, the other priorities that we have in Minnesota. So in conclusion, no other state has really taken this path that we have. We decided to not wait for federal action, but to move into this proactively and start looking at ways that the private market can be made more substantial. And we're hoping that, if we see more conversations at the federal level, that we have put Minnesota in a good position to be involved in that in the future. Thank you so much for your attention. I don't know how you want to handle questions, but, Fred Anderson would be happy to talk more about life stage at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Kanata-Rood. And I'm very intrigued about these ideas for the policy. So I'd like to hear more maybe from Mr. Anderson from the Department of Commerce to talk about more specifics about this term life insurance with long-term care insurance coverage, how that could work in Minnesota, and if we need to create new state statutes or anything to allow these products to be sold in Minnesota.
Okay, thank you very much. Fred Anderson, Minnesota Department of Commerce. And regarding the life stage product, a reason why it's so important to develop a product like this is that most people don't start thinking about their future long-term care needs until they're around age 57, 58, 59, 60. And by then, starting to save for future long-term care events or starting to think about buying insurance for long-term care events, it becomes unaffordable with unpredictable costs involved. So the life stage, as Lorraine mentioned, provides an attractive option to younger people to take care of their immediate need of term life insurance and also get an early start on funding future long-term care needs. And the earlier you get started, the cheaper it is to fund your future long-term care needs. Now, regarding kind of setting up a structure for this product to be available in Minnesota, fortunately, Minnesota law contains more flexibility than other states' laws do regarding combining life insurance and long-term care products. And we've reached out to some companies, and companies are interested in selling this product in Minnesota. However, a common theme is these companies say that they need the scale of selling to multiple states to make it a good deal for them, and they can't just sell it here and make money. So a venue for encouraging the approval of insurance products in multiple states is called the Interstate Compact. So this is, most states are involved in this Interstate Compact. And it's an entity that allows development of standards for approving insurance products. So we are currently in discussion with other states and the Interstate Compact to encourage the development of standards that will allow approval of the life stage product in multiple states. And we think once this product is approvable in multiple states, that companies will be interested in selling to multiple states, including Minnesota.
Thank you. Are other states pursuing legislation to allow these products to be sold?
At the current time, the state insurance departments, I had a discussion with them in February, and they're hoping that the Interstate Compact can be the approach for approving these products because they feel that's more of an expedited process than going through 50 state legislatures. But it's possible that's not going to work out, and at that point, all the state legislatures will have to be involved.
So if it's approved at the compact level, it won't need to go to be approved by through the state legislatures.
Correct.
Thank you, Mr.
In most cases.
Okay. Representative Munson.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, if it isn't approved at the compact level and we have to approve this product at a state level, and someone was to, you know, 30 or 40 years old, start buying this product and then retire to Arizona before this product was needed for long-term care, would they still be able to pay premiums on the product living in a state where it wasn't allowed?
Mr. Anderson?
Okay, thank you, Representative. If you buy a product in a state, you can move and the product still applies.
Okay.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, are you looking at any type of tax advantages to incentivize purchase of this in terms of tax deductibility or something along that nature?
Mrs. Knudel.
Madam Chair, Representative, we're starting now to talk about outreach strategies. As Fred said, we have some other things related to approval, but that is something that has been on our list to look at more thoroughly. We, as I said, had the Revenue Department involved, and so we could take a look at that.
Representative Grunhagen, you might be working on a bill.
Yeah. Huh?
Sounds good.
And Madam Chair, just one
yep,
more.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, we did have a compact bill introduced a number of years ago in relationship to insurance. I think I was a co-author on it, to tell you the truth. But I just can't remember exactly how, what the ramifications were right offhand. But that had been discussed at one time, but it never really went anywhere. But I think that's a good idea because it's a way for the companies to spread their risk over a number of different states at one time, which is what they need to do in order to have a profitable product that's competitive.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Mr. Anderson, do you know how many states would be the number we needed to be viable?
I'm trying to think of the venue, but I know Illinois is interested, and it depends on how big the states are. If we got Illinois, Texas, California, and Florida, I think that would be enough. But I would say probably representative of 25% of the U.S. population. So however we get there.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Representative Cleaborn?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. When I was thinking about these products, when I was reviewing for this committee meeting today, one of the things that many of these types of products have are the 100-day waiting period. You have to be diagnosed with limited ability for 3 average daily activities, and then you have this 100-day waiting period, and families scramble to deal with that. Would this type of plan product have that same 100-day waiting?
Mr. Anderson?
I'll give it a shot. Okay, thank you, Representative. I would imagine this product would have different price categories, and you could probably have a shorter waiting period at a more expensive price or a longer waiting period at a less expensive price.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Grunhagen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just for clarification on that, I've sold Medicare supplements for about 30 years, and the idea of the waiting period was your Medicare supplement, Medicare, used to pick up the first 100 days. But Medicare has changed their rules over a period of time, and now you have to be showing improvement or they won't pay. So what used to be covered automatically through Medicare and your supplement for 100 days is now much more difficult to collect on. Yeah. And, again, Medicare has tightened up their rules as far as that's concerned.
Mr. Anderson, but Commerce would regulate these types of products, and we could put in legislation that kind of helps structure these products?
Thank you, Representative. My personal belief is that I believe that our law already allows these products. We have a special part of the law that says you cannot have combination products unless one of the two aspects is long-term care. So I think that would allow us to approve this product. It's just other states don't have that similar law.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to move on to Professor Lynn Blewett's presentation from the University of Minnesota and how it connects. I noticed you have lots of great, wonderful quantitative slides, so we have 20 more minutes, and we want to leave 5 minutes for Q&A.
Okay, thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed.
I'm Lynn Blewett. I'm a professor in the School of Public Health, the Division of Health Policy and Management, and I am with the, I direct the State Health Access Data Assistance Center at the university. We are a applied research center located there, and we do a lot of work on health insurance coverage, access to care. Our focus is on using data and evidence-based research to inform state health policy.
And it's pronounced, the acronym is pronounced SHADAC. Is that correct?
SHADAC.
SHADAC.
Yeah, so we're a multidisciplinary research center, and was happy to work with LaRae and the Own Your Futures Project to work on this long-term care service and support model. We had a collaborative effort. We worked with LaRae, and she had two consultants, one from an actuarial firm, one from the insurance industry, that informed our work, and it was really a great it was a great project, and I'll share some with you. I'm going to go kind of quickly through some of these slides so we have time for questions, but can always come back and provide information as needed. So as you know, the elderly and disabled make up about 20% of the Medicaid population, but consume about 58% of the costs. For this project, we focused on long-term care services and supports for the elderly. We carved out the disabled. We understand the disabled is really a key component of these costs, but we wanted to have a manageable project and focused on long-term care services and supports. And their average cost, and this is state of Minnesota, is $13,300 a year. As you know, long-term care expenditures are a large and growing part of state budgets. This just shows trends over time. In the middle line is the nursing facility costs. The lower line is home and community-based services. The total Medicaid budget is about $15 billion, and Medicaid for long-term care services and support make up 58% of that. You've heard from LaRae on the growth of the Minnesota's aging population. This just illustrates that, which is the top line, the yellow line, is 18 to 64-year-olds. We see a decline in the younger population in the middle. And then the growth of the age 65 and older, which are going to be 20 to 25% of the population in the near future. So Minnesota has been at the forefront and is well known across the country in terms of its focus on keeping people out of the nursing home and focused on use of home and community-based services called rebalancing, moving people from the nursing home and maintaining them in the community. And we do that through the Medicaid waiver program, the alternative care program, and state-funded community services. And there's been a decline in nursing facility use over this time period of about 25%. So our model was trying to figure out what do we spend on long-term care services and supports, and then what is that going to look like in the future, and can we develop policies and analyze policies on the effect of those costs over time. So our focus was on using Minnesota-specific data, and this was a bonus, which was our collaboration with DHS to have access to the MMIS, the actual microdata for the claims and costs. So we have really good data on utilization and costs for Minnesota-specific elderly and Medicaid enrollees. Again, we focused on 65 years and older, and we carved out the disabled, and we also carved out the acute care for long-term care. We were really focused on those long-term care needs. Another plus to this project is we were able to use Minnesota, the MMIS data from DHS, but we also had a lot of Minnesota-specific data from other data sources. And the idea was, you know, Minnesota has a unique elderly and demographics. We live longer. We have a healthier population. We have a unique mix of nursing facilities and home and community-based services. So the idea was to try to develop a home-based kind of grassroots model. There are several models at the national level, but we wanted to sort of get something that the state could use over time. So a few notes on the data. This is, again, our trying to figure out not that short-term 100-day stay, but the longer-term stays, and this was just the definition on how we did that. So this is our basic projection. So we have 215. The year 2015 was our baseline data for the Minnesota population, and we projected mortality into the future. We looked at years 2020 and 2030. Then we looked at ADLs. We have a cognition score, and then we have a chronic condition score. We looked at Medicaid eligibility. We looked at the impact of current long-term care insurance, and then whether they use the projection of whether they would use nursing facility and home and community-based services. This is a kind of a complicated flowchart, but we spent a lot of time on doing this. This is the Medicaid eligibility determination process for long-term services and sports. And this is the actual Minnesota. So we run all our people through this. And as you know, the Medicaid eligibility is 100% of the federal poverty level. And this, it depends on if you're living in the community, if you have a spouse living in the community, do you own a home? And these are all the different pathways that you can go through. And it was an interesting exercise, and I think you could maybe tweak some of these boxes, but in essence, it's based on income and assets. So this is just an example of our model. So we put everybody into cohorts. So this is cohort 42, which has males 60 to 64, males who are living white, urban area, 0 to 1 ADLs, and they're not currently eligible for Medicaid. So everybody in our model fits into one of these cohorts. And then we project to 2030 and the 2020 and then 2030 on where we think they're going to be based on the available data in 2020. So for this example, this cohort, above the dotted line are Medicaid eligibles, and then below are non-Medicaid eligibles, and then, of course, you know, a certain number of this population is going to decrease over time. So some of, if you look above on the yellow, the second yellow chart, so they age, they're now older, they're still white and urban, they gained 2 ADLs, and their income made them eligible for Medicaid. And then we project out what are they going to use for services, nursing facility, home and community-based care. And then, you know, interestingly, even if you're on Medicaid, a significant number do not use any long-term care services and supports. We then look at the average cost of these services. So we figure out are they going to use nursing facilities or home and community based. Then we look at the average cost, and it's basic math of just multiplying out and estimating the costs of what the projection is going to be. So again, we try to use the best available data to inform this model. We're presenting it in a simplified way, but all of it is based on data and projections into the future. So this is some of our baseline data. Where's my pie charts? There we go. So this is actual Minnesota Medicaid data now for 2015. So the total number of people in our sample is about 55,000, which is kind of interesting to me when you think about the total spending and how much it is. But it's only 55,000 people, mm-hmm. And so that is, you know. The nursing facility represents 12% of that population, while the home and community base is about 104%. And so you can see this trend over time from the baseline of 55,000 people to 94,000 people, which is an increase of about 76%. This is, again, actual Medicaid data. So this shows the distribution of, you know, where our long-term services and support spending goes. And, again, this is excluding the acute care and excluding that short-term nursing home stay, so it's really long-term. And you can see, even though we've rebalanced and there's more home and community-based, the nursing facilities are still the driver. And one out of every two nursing home residents is a Medicaid recipient. So this just illustrates that 62-thirds of the population are nursing facility, followed by personal care, customized living, adult foster care, and all other. When you pull out the community-based services, so this is, the again, actual data, you can see this is the community-based distribution of the community-based services, and so personal care is the dominant mode of treatment, then customized living, adult foster care, and all other. And that customized living would be care provided in assisted living facilities. So then we take that baseline, which is really good, actual data from DHS that we've used, and project that out into the future. And you can see from this slide this trend in trend over time. And again, we're using existing distribution of how we care for people in the home and community-based setting. So we didn't alter the supply or change of practice patterns. It is the same. And the increase in nursing facility residents in terms of cost was 55%, and the use of home and community-based services was 99%. But the gap between those two is decreasing over time. When you look at the utilization and cost projections over time, we see between 2015 to 2030 an increase of almost 3%. So if we do nothing and everything exists as is, that's going to be the expected. That's what we expect for a trend in long-term services and supports from about $1 billion to $1.7 billion in services. So as part of our project with the Own Your Futures, we looked at the two benefits that Lorray described, the enhanced home community benefit and then life stage project. And we plugged these into the model saying, well, what if we had these now and people bought them and took them up, and what impact would that have on our projected spend in Medicaid for long-term services and supports? So the enhanced home care benefit is basically a non-medical chore service, service coordination, a daycare, maximum daily benefit of $100, lifetime benefit of $50,000, and this would be a mandated benefit embedded in Medicare Advantage and Medigap plans. And then the life stage project we just talked about with Mr. Anderson. This is our benefit. So this was our projection of embedding the home care benefit in the Medicare supplemental products, and our projection over time would have an impact of about reducing health care spending by about 20%. We didn't find similar trends with the life stage product, but mostly because it's brand new, we don't have any actual data on take up. So we think if we were redoing a little bit of our assumptions on that product, and then also trying to add more years, we think if we projected out more years, we might have additional savings for that. So in summary, this was a project that we worked on with the Own Your Futures project. There's a state platform that can be added to or developed over time. We use Minnesota state specific data. It's a collaborative program working with DHS and actually having good data on utilization and costs that's actual and specific to Minnesota. And then just acknowledging the disability service costs are key to these trend issues as well. So right now we're working on ongoing refinements. We're trying to think if we're looking at the income variable and trying to make it more flexible so we can look at potential like savings projects, policies, or other long-term care insurance options like life stage. We're looking at social determinants of health. What about implementing a program to help with food security? And then also, what if there was a cure for Alzheimer's? You know, what would that happen to Minnesota projections? So we have a significant trigger for nursing facility uses is cognitive function, so we have that as a component in the model. And then we don't look at provider supply, but that's something that could be looked at if there were interest. So this, again, was collaboration with Shadak and Giovanni Alcaron, Robert Hess, Mark Woodhouse, and Ben Capistrand, and then our Own Your Future projects with Lorray and Marie Zimmerman as the Medicaid director, and the consultants John O'Leary and John Cutler. So, happy to take questions.
Thank you, Professor Blewett. So this really tees it up well for next week, because we're going to be talking about how we pay workers in the home and community-based service area and the great need we will have for those workers and those providers. So it's really interesting work that you have done with your colleagues at the university that I know that the state can benefit from. So thank you. And I think we have a couple questions. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this was really interesting. So on the slide on page 14, the slide that shows the estimated cost savings in long-term care with these products, if they were available, is showing a good amount of savings. Do you know how that impacts what the spending then for individuals would be? I mean, we're talking about state spending or, overall spending, but how does that impact what families would be paying, or, they might be paying premium costs, or we see a savings in one area, but do we see an increased amount of spending than individuals are doing on their own? How does that Like, what are some consequences of us saving in this realm, which looks great, but what are some other impacts of products like these and what these mean for families' pocketbooks?
Professor Blewett?
Representative Schultz and Representative Olson, I don't have specific individual actual numbers, but if you think, you know, the way that we do the modeling is the savings on the income side. So if you have long-term care insurance, that protects your income, or if you had one of these life stage products. So as you get closer to the Medicaid population, and really is at that kind of that near, you know, 100 to 150, 100 to 200% of federal poverty, you have protection of your income, you're less likely to spend down.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm learning, these are new things for me, so I'm learning how that works, but just want to understand that. Thank you.
I think that's a great question, Representative Olson, because if people have this product, they wouldn't have to spend down their income and assets to get eligible for MA for long-term care. So they say, but they do spend out-of-pocket a premium every month, and I think that was what Representative Olson was getting to, is that then it's a monthly premium, but hopefully that will be a small compared to how much income they would save because they wouldn't have to spend down.
Right.
But if you have any more information on that, that's a great thing to explore, that trade-off between out-of-pocket spending and what the state is spending. Other questions? Representative Cleavorn?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, when you were doing this study, because you're looking at a target market of 35 to 55-year-olds, these are also years where families are spending the greatest amount of money in buying homes, raising families. Was there any factor in looking at this that took that into consideration as to whether or not the products would be acceptable for people?
Professor Blewett?
Madam Chair and Representative Cleavorn. John O'Leary, who was one of the actuaries or one of the long-term care insurance industry, has done a lot of studies in terms of acceptability of these products and take-up and at what age and at what income. So we did have some of those assumptions in the model. It's something that, you know, that's something they're trying to sell to younger people as opposed to sort of waiting over time. So I don't know if you want to add to that, Larray, but...
I would just add to that we did focus groups. We did four focus groups for this particular product for the life stage. And so it included people, you know, with defined parameters, and people of a certain income, people working in various occupations, so that we got some diversity that way. I'm not sure exactly, you know, if that fits with what you're talking about, but we tried to take a look at, a diversity of people in that age range to see what the take-up might be. And the people involved in the marketing studies that the Society of Actuaries did on this particular product, they found in the Chicago market that this was some of the highest interest that they had seen in term life insurance products. And this is actually a combo. So that was encouraging to hear.
Thank you. And Representative Cleavorn, it looks like in the packet the product would be around $45 per month for a 40-year-old woman. So for some it could be affordable. For others that might not be affordable depending on their income. Do you have another question?
No. That's all. Thank you.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 14 of the handout, when it talks about the policies evaluated, the home care benefit looks like there's a lifetime benefit of $50,000 is one of the products you're looking at. Is there also lifetime benefits on the nursing home care that you've seen? And are those kind of agreed upon amounts? Like it says $100 per day. Is that agreed upon? Or is it go up as time goes over? I mean, as time goes on, it seems like 30 years from now they might be spending more than $100 a day.
Sure. Madam Chair, Ms. Representative, we put together a prototype that we could use for doing the actuarial and the consumer focus groups. And so if this were developed, say, by an insurance carrier, they might want to do very different things if their market studies show that there's a greater interest in maybe some way of saving or reducing the premium. Others want more protection, so they wouldn't mind a higher premium. We just did kind of a basic prototype to get the, you know, to get a sense of what the cost would be for the premium. But I think an insurance carrier would have the flexibility to set up many of those parameters however they felt it would suit the market.
Okay. Yeah, and I have a reference for you, Representative Munson. I can share with you via email to get more information on what companies have projected and modeled as well. Any other questions? No, I'm not seeing any. So thank you so much, you. Professor Blewett and Ms. Knutterud, for you. Presenting it. Very interesting information. I hope we can take this back and come up with some ideas to address our long-term care needs in the state of Minnesota. So really appreciate you being here. And with that, I am going to adjourn the Division of Long-Term Care. Thanks, everybody.